Welcome back to our second podcast for the Illawarra Shoalhaven Emergency Medicine Education and Training Program. We've all had the experience of sitting back and working through results in the FirstNet system, finding large numbers of MSU results that are positive, and then going back to find in the notes that this was the test done in a patient with chest pain or shortness of breath or epistaxis or pink hair or blue eyebrows. The difficulty in trying to work out why this test was done in the first place. So what's the problem with this? Largely it's a problem of these results driving over-treatment of urinary tract infections, of anchoring diagnoses so that when we find a positive MSU, we stop thinking about other potential diagnoses in this particular patient, and ultimately of, as a result of the over-treatment and the overuse of antibiotics, the burgeoning issue with antibiotic resistance. What drives the phenomenon? It's really a combination of things. One of them is it's reflex testing. So the patient comes in, they pass urine, the nurse, as a matter of course, does a dipstick on the urine test that she has. She finds a positive dipstick test, either for leukocytes or nitrites, or both. And as a result, the test gets sent off, irrespective of what the presenting issue was. Secondly, we do urine testing almost reflexly in elderly patients who come in with cognitive decline or falls in a setting where there is a significant prevalence of urinary tract infection, but also of asymptomatic bacteria. And those two things combined produce a high volume of urine testing. What fuels this really is a significant mythology around urinary tract infections. That mythology has been very competently reviewed in an article in the Journal of Emergency Medicine from 2016, which is Top 10 Myths Regarding the Diagnosis and Treatment of Urinary Tract Infections by Lucas Schultz, Robert Hoffman and Jeffrey Potthoff. They outline 10 myths in association with urinary tract infections, and I'm going to go through each of those and talk through ostensibly what they provide in the way of the evidence. The first myth, which we've all heard, is this patient's urine is cloudy and smells really bad. The inference being that premised on the cloudiness of the urine or the smell of the urine, we're able to tell that this person has a likely urinary tract infection. In fact, urine colour and clarity, or the smell of the urine, shouldn't be used, particularly not alone, to diagnose or start antibiotic therapy in any patient population. When you look at visual inspection of urine clarity and study that, it's actually not been helpful in diagnosing urinary tract infection in women. 100 female patients in a university hospital had the urine tested by reading newsprint through the sample. Interesting way of viewing a newspaper. What they found was that the sensitivity for urinary tract infection in this circumstance was 13.3%, so didn't really pick up the urinary tract infections in many. The specificity was 96.5%. When they've looked at the impact of smell with respect to determining if somebody has a urinary tract infection, foul-smelling urine is found to be unreliable as well, particularly notable in catheterized patients. And it's usually more dependent on the patient's hydration status and on the concentration of urea in the urine. Myth number two, urine has bacteria present, therefore my patient has a urinary tract infection. Actually, the presence of bacteria in urine on microscopic examination or by positive culture without urinary tract infection symptoms is actually not an indication of urinary tract infection. The likelihood of contamination remains, and a significant proportion of patients, particularly in the group that we're often testing, have actually asymptomatic bacteria. Urinary tract infection isn't a laboratory-defined diagnosis. It should be based first, like any other test, there should be what are the clinical symptoms, what's the pretest probability, then look at the test result in the light of that pretest probability. So you're using the test itself to confirm what your pretest thoughts were. when we're considering whether or not a urine test is positive, we look at the number of colony forming units per mil and determine on numbers whether or not that's likely to be urinary tract infection. That can't be used as a guide in asymptomatic patients. In symptomatic females, colony counts of greater than 10 to the 2 colony forming units per mil are useful clinically. In symptomatic males, colony counts of greater than 10 to the 2 colony forming units are usually clinically relevant for a diagnosis of UTI or prostatitis. Myth number 3 is related to the finding of epithelial cells when you look in the low power field. So my patient's urine sample has greater than 5 squamous epithelial cells per low power field. The culture is positive. Because the culture is positive for a single organism, I can disregard the epithelial cell count and treat the UTI. You'll usually see in the report on this when you're doing the EMR assessments that the suggestion from the microbiologist is quite correct, that this can't be used as a method of determining whether or not the person's got a urinary tract infection, and there should be a repeat sample if you seriously think that's likely to be a diagnosis. Myth number 4. The urine has a positive leukocyte esterase. My patient should have a urine culture performed, has a UTI, and needs antibiotics. This is the circumstance wherein the reflex collection of an MSU and sending for culture is likely to get us into a bit of trouble. The leukocyte esterase test per se on the dipstick shouldn't be used alone to support a diagnosis of a urinary tract infection. And systems where you reflexly send the sample off are much more likely to lead to a false positive result. The dipstick test, leukocyte esterase test, has a high sensitivity and specificity for the presence of white cells in the urine. Ostensibly what it's testing is, or looking for, is an enzyme that comes from predominantly neutrophils, basophils, eosinophils. It doesn't come out of lymphocytes. A positive test alone isn't recommended, though, for the diagnosis of urinary tract infection. You have to have the symptoms to go along with it beforehand before you can actually make that sort of diagnosis. If you ignore the preceding symptom complex, then you're likely to end up with an overtreatment rate somewhere in the vicinity of about 47%. Myth number 5 relates to the next phase in urine testing, which is the microscopy and cell counts, particularly white cell counts, and that is the presence of pyuria being equated with a diagnosis of a UTI. That doesn't work in both directions. In neutropenic or leukopenic patients, they might have such a low white cell count generally in their in the system that despite the presence of urinary tract symptoms, they still turn up with an inadequate white cell count in the urine to convince us that it's a UTI. If you have people who've got borderline 6 to 10 cells per mil, that might in fact reflect a patient's state of hydration. So for example, if you've got a patient with oliguria or anuria, they will usually have some degree of pyuria. So small amounts of urine, very concentrated, you're going to end up with more in the way of white cells per mil. There are also non-infectious conditions, such as acute renal failure, sexually transmitted infections, or non-infectious cystitis that can result in pyuria, which is not the diagnosis of urinary tract infection. Myth number 6, that the urine has nitrites present, my patient has a UTI. The first thing to point out here is we often talk about nitrates, but in fact what we are looking for is nitrites. Nitrites are what's produced when the bacterial enzymes work on the nitrates. So there's often nitrates in the urine. It's what the bacteria do to the nitrates, turning them into nitrites, that we're actually trying to test for. Ostensibly what we often do is we equate a positive urinary nitrite with a urinary tract infection. In fact, all that the positive nitrites really prove is that bacteria are present. It's got a high true positive rate for the presence of bacteria. That does not necessarily equate, though, to a urinary tract infection in the absence of symptoms. What it can be useful for in that premise is that if you have a negative urinary leukocyte esterase and a negative urinary nitrite, that largely rules out infection, particularly in pregnant women, elderly patients, general practice patients, and urology patients. you'd need to go looking for alternative diagnoses as to the likely cause for whatever the presenting feature is. The combination of a negative leukocyte esterase and a negative nitrite has a negative predictive value of about 88%. That still leaves you about a 1 in 10 chance that in the absence of those you have a urinary tract infection, but it certainly significantly drops the likelihood. Even if both the leukocyte esterase and the nitrites are positive, the sensitivity for bacteria is only about 48%, so highly specific but not particularly sensitive. And that's particularly true amongst elderly nursing home patients. So what we need to do, again, coming back to the very beginning, is that you've got to correlate those findings with whatever your clinical picture is. Number seven is that if you have bacteria in a catheterized urine sample, that should be diagnosed as a urinary tract infection. What we know is that virtually 100% of patients with an indwelling catheter are colonized within 2 weeks of placement, and usually with somewhere between 2 and 5 organisms. The colony counts define bacteriuria, but they have to be taken into the clinical context of what other evidence do we have for a urinary tract infection. In one particular study back in 1982 where they looked at this, 98% of chronically catheterized patients had bacteriuria, and 77% of those had multiple organisms. And the mean interval between episodes of bacteriuria with new organisms was roughly 1.8 weeks. So you should only treat bacteriuria and pyuria in people who've got long-term catheters in place in the presence of other signs or symptoms suggestive of infection when they're assessable. So fever, suprapubic pain, tenderness, obviously dysuria is not really going to be an issue in those people. Pyuria or bacteria alone is not an indication for antibiotics. Even if you decide to use antibiotics in some sort of prophylactic way, it might delay the onset of bacteria in those catheterized patients, but all that results in is that they get colonized with resistant organisms. Myth number eight is the idea that patients who have bacteriuria are somehow in sort of a prodromal phase leading up to urinary tract infection, and therefore we should treat them on that premise. But bacteria itself doesn't establish a diagnosis of UTI, and if you've got an asymptomatic patient, you shouldn't actually commence them on antibiotics. There have been a number of studies looking at the prevalence of asymptomatic bacteria, particularly in populations like residential care facilities. In one particular set of circumstances, the information that we've got is that the prevalence of bacteria in elderly institutionalized patients without indwelling catheters, it will vary between 25 and 50% in women and 15 to 49% for men. And the older they are, the more likely it is that they will have asymptomatic bacteria. So to a large degree, it's almost an expected finding in the elderly, and particularly in the elderly in institutionalized circumstances. Symptomatic urinary tract infection is actually substantially less common than asymptomatic bacteriuria. Another important thing to realise that asymptomatic bacteria has not been associated with any long-term negative outcomes like pyelonephritis, sepsis, renal failure, or hypertension. One interesting finding from an article in the Journal of Clinical and Infectious Diseases from 2012 found that in younger women with true recurrent urinary tract infections, so representers defined urinary tract infections on multiple occasions, that if they had asymptomatic bacteria, that was actually protective for future UTIs because they were actually being colonized with less pathogenic organisms. Myth number nine relates to that very common and ennui-inducing presentation of the elderly patient, particularly from the residential care facility, who comes in either with falls or with an altered level of cognition. The thing to bear in mind here is that particular presentation, acute alteration in mental status, functional decline, and non-specific clinical manifestations of a lot of different circumstances, ranging from simple dehydration through to hypoxia and polypharmacy reactions, given the number of medications that most of them are on. So you have to correlate other signs of systemic inflammation and infection with that particular pattern to start determining whether that person actually has a urinary tract infection or not. The unfortunate thing is that we have a group of patients in which falls and altered cognition are common, and asymptomatic bacteriuria is common. So how do we sort through that particular mix? Not a lot of evidence to help us here. The general suggestion, however, is that if you have someone who is elderly, who has an acute mental status change, but they don't show other signs of clinical instability, it's probably reasonable to hold off trying to treat them with antibiotics for urinary tract infection until you've given them 24 to 48 hours to see how things progress and to see if you can identify an alternative cause for their particular presentation. In essence, that's saying that the diagnosis of a UTI in these people is in some ways a diagnosis of exclusion. It could be argued, why get too concerned? Just start them on the antibiotics and, you know, wait and see how things settle down on the antibiotics. But one of the big things that we tend to miss in this process is that whole concept creates anchoring. It says to subsequent people looking after those particular patients, this patient has a UTI, therefore we stop thinking about alternative diagnoses. So far better to flip that on its head, wait and see what else comes up, continue to investigate, to manipulate medications, to try and achieve an outcome for the patient. If all else fails, then move on to treating this as a urinary tract infection. The final myth doesn't have a lot of relevance for emergency department assessment, and it relates to the presence of yeast or candida in the urine. When we get a result like that, most commonly that's going to be a colonizing agent, unless you have someone who has neutropenia or significant immunosuppression. Usually this becomes an issue in patients who are in intensive care units rather than presenting to us in emergency departments. It's interesting to look at some of the information that comes out of the US on things like the overtreatment of asymptomatic bacteria, and in particular to look at the frequency, which they've rated as 40% of antibiotics administered for a presumed UTI having been avoidable. And that the overprescribing of antibiotics has generated antibiotic resistance among organisms that continue to create problems for us within the health system. So, to sum all this up, what does it mean? It means that when we're thinking about and testing for urinary tract infections, it's a test like any other test. Think about, in terms of probabilities, before you test for it, what's the likelihood that a urinary tract infection is in fact the cause of what's in front of me? Don't just send off an MSU for testing on the premise that we've just got to cover that or we've come up with a positive dipstick, despite the fact that the patient is actually not presented with any symptoms that are really truly referable to an inflammatory infective process going on in front of them. So if you've got dysuria, if you've got urinary symptoms, if you've got evidence of sepsis, by all means, test for it. But if you've got the chest pain, the pink hair, the purple eyebrows, and you just happen to turn up a dipstick that shows positive for nitrites, leukocytes, either or both, don't use that as a trigger for sending off an MSU. Think twice before you send it. That's it for this time around. Until next time, stay good and always ask yourself the question, is this really the diagnosis that I'm expecting it to be?